You're listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. Living on Goombangya country in Australia, this is your host, Lucy Van Zambeek. Welcome back to Talk the Walk. My guest today is Michelle Bates, a narrative practitioner living and working in Tennant Creek on Wurrumungu country. Michelle moved to the remote community in the Northern Territory in 2014 after growing up in Sydney's southwest and working in other parts of New South Wales. Michelle has an incredibly long list of diverse roles in her community, which includes mentorship, community development, team leadership, policy advice, foster care, and of course, therapeutic practice. Her individual and group work focuses on Aboriginal children, families, and women living with a disability who experience violence in their everyday lives. Although she has many passions when it comes to advocacy for and with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, Michelle is a formidable force as a member of the First Peoples Disability Network. She's also been instrumental in establishing and coordinating the Patterson Street Hub, a culturally safe space in which people meet, connect, share and learn. Michelle, I've heard lots of wonderful things about the Hub and I'm very excited to be talking with you today to hear about some of your work. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be here, Lucy.
Michelle, how did you come to be in Tennant Creek? This is a story I'm really interested in hearing about. What was it that drew you to that place?
Well, when I first committed to coming to Wurrumungu country, I had some idea of what to expect in part, as I'd spent half a year in Alice Springs, which is about 500 kilometres south. I'd travelled to the centre several times across many years, and I'd also been to Tennant Creek, yet I hadn't spent much time at all sitting and really listening in to the people and to the place, but I was very curious. What I expected was a small town, remote living, some time out bush, a big blue sky, and plenty of time with and around people in community. I think what drew me, my curiosity really was around the national disability reform that was happening at the time. And I'd worked in the area of disability support in lots of different roles for more than 30 years. In fact, I reflect now about all the growing up I did in my connections with individuals and their families, children, young adults, with the lived experience of disability. So the National Disability Insurance Scheme was rolling out a trial in a remote context in Tennant Creek. And I committed to come and see for 3 months. Then I extended to 6 months. And then I decided to see the year out. And in that time, I'd made connections and quite deep relationships with Wurrumungu and others, and also with the place. So I'm still here.
Yeah, it's only through landing in a place and really discovering that place, those people, and starting to listen to their stories that you start to form a bit of a connection, and that could turn into something longer, hey?
That's right. And it was unforeseen. It was just a little bit of an adventure, and now it's a much longer, much more anchored adventure and commitment to the place. I've been reflecting and thinking that it's something about now I face the good challenge of, well, what do I do now in terms of my responsibility to my family, my children, adult children, my aging, old, lovely parents? And the challenge is probably a different kind of compromise, but figuring out how I can turn my back on what I know. It's something I grapple with.
So at the moment, you're kind of in a place of, I really love this place, I love the work that I'm doing, but you've also got some responsibilities that you're starting to think about to your children, your aging parents.
Yeah, that's it.
So what keeps you there? What keeps you in Tennant Creek?
I think I've quickly developed loyalty. I think it's a, you know, both a value and a characteristic for me, the bit of a thread throughout my life. And I can't unsee or unfeel or unhear what I have. And I feel compelled to try to make a contribution towards improvement and better, and with people whose home it is here. There are so many daily challenges that it's sometimes hard for people to find the time and strength and focus for the work that needs to be done in community, the systems that need challenging, the support of other community or family members that is needed in order for people to keep on with their parenting and keep on with their community roles in the face of hardship.
So would you say that challenging the systems is something that sort of drives you, is part of this passion for your work? Or are there other things that inspire you to continue to work in Tennant Creek, doing what you're doing?
I think, Lucy, it's a bit of both. So I feel like I am learning more and more and more about the business of systems change and challenging systems. So on the one hand, I get a fair bit of exposure to that through advocacy work, which I really love. Yet if I spent all of my time challenging systems and processes to try to improve experiences for First Peoples living with a disability and others, then I think I might go mad. And so the other part of life here is remote living and being in relationship with people for whom this country has been their home and their family's home for many, many years. So I think in the time I've been here, I understand more fully beyond the aesthetic beauty of the country. I mean, the country is breathtaking. The air is fresh, especially at this time of year. It's clear. In other seasons, it can be so, so hot. Yet people keep living. They keep doing. We all need to be together and find ways to keep living well together in this space. And I take a lot of relief, and it's almost like a grace from the movement across the country of the light, for example. I have such a renewed appreciation for the sun going down and the moody sunsets here, and the way the light gives so much texture and colour to the skies. It's really uplifting, and I love it. I love the country. I really appreciate many people, so many Umburani people. Umburani is a Wurrumungu word for Aboriginal people. Their commitment to place and their commitment to their families and their want for better lives, easier lives for generations to come.
So I'm wondering if you identify with a bit of a connection to both of those things, that there's a bit of a history to wanting to challenge systems, as well as a history of finding a place of living well together in your life. Can you identify with those two kind of themes, that this is something that's been important to you for some time?
Yes, I do. I think my desire to develop more skill around the area of working towards systems change, working with the conditions that hold, problem stories in place, is a commitment that I've held for some time. It's just being here somehow has brought problem stories, significant problem stories, right to my front door. And one of the things that challenges the beauty and the strengths of the place are the presence of those enduring problem stories. And so in order to live here, I must give energy to working with others to try to improve circumstances for people. It's not, for me, not negotiable. And then there is something about what you spoke to around the place. I certainly, I can think back and recall absolute sense of place and belonging when I was raising my three sons. There was home and there was connection and there was structure and rhythm. And so it's probably no coincidence that I've afforded myself this time to live remotely and to live this experience here in Tennant Creek when my three sons have grown older and come to an age where I didn't need to be necessarily providing for them and around them all the time. And yet I find myself here replicating some aspects of that life before in mm-hmm. my foster care role, in my community development role, in my the helping roles that I take up in town. But I definitely do feel I'm well anchored here, which was not my intention, but I'm grateful. I'm grateful for the opportunity to feel a part of a place that holds so much richness and so much opportunity to try to serve others.
I'm wondering if you could share a particular time, perhaps a story from this experience that you had raising three sons and how important that was to create a sense of home and connection and structure for them, this sense of belonging. I wonder if there's a particular time when you were raising your children that this sort of came to light for you, how important this was.
I can think right back to my early childhood, and I grew up alongside my cousin Jason, who was born with Down syndrome, which also links to my long-held roles with working alongside people living with a disability. Mm. Yet I saw that he was very well held within our family and extended family, even though there were really tough times for his mother and father. He was very energetic and sometimes not fully understood, and it was very hard for him to express himself and make sense of the world. Yet I saw what it took from the adults around to just kind of fall down but get up again. His family, that's what you do. And that's very strong value of my own parents. My mother holds such grace and determination to grow family. So she had three sons and myself, and family's always been central to our lives. And so it kind of made complete sense to me that even as a young girl, I recall thinking, 11 and 12, after spending a lot of time being a cousin childminder to my cousin Jason and spending lots of time with him, I felt the nurturing qualities grow. I can think back and think, yeah, one of my natural pathways was to one day nurture a family of my own, without question. And so it made complete sense. And Michael, my children's father, and I created a home for our children in which to grow. The other significant influences were women that I'd met at that time in my younger, 20s, and they already had a strong sense of family and nurturing and finding their way in those roles. And so I felt really well held by them and their modelling. Yeah, it kind of would be easy to say, oh, yeah, I'm a nurturer. But there's nothing saintly about me. It is also about what the role of nurturer brings to me. It keeps me accountable. It helps, it challenges me. It helps me reflect. It helps me to be better versions of myself through the struggles that children face in growing up.
I'm interested in this role of nurturer and how you've seen that role kind of played out in Aboriginal communities. What's been your reflections there? Have you developed a sense of connection with women, I guess, that you're working with, given that you've really connected to this role yourself from an early age, and your experiences of growing up in a family where there was home and there was a nurturing environment? Has that been a connection for you that has influenced your understandings of working with people in Tennant Creek?
Yes, that's a big, juicy question. And I can honour it by approaching it this way. I think to understand the way nurturing plays out in a town like Tennant Creek, in a place like the Barkly, which is the area, the many hundreds of thousands of square metres that surrounds the town of Tennant Creek, it's a local government area, I have observed many different types of nurturing. And it's important to understand the histories of the place, the histories of Aboriginal First Peoples relationships with other Australians in this country, it's kind of easy to pull in the talk about government legislation and other, you know, frameworks or rules or laws that have impacted Aboriginal people over hundreds of years. But I see it here. So I've read about it in other contexts. I've had an understanding of the impact. I've seen the impact in urban and regional and other remote areas. But in this place, I've come to know and understand some of Warramunga culture and people's relationship with their country, people's relationship with each other, and their relationships to the wounds and history's deep impact. And so I'm very careful about speaking on behalf of Warramunga people, yet what I notice is combinations of extremely strong, steadfast nurturing and people in nurturing roles who struggle with distraction and perhaps mental ill health and living in overcrowded and desperate situations, living with people who also in different ways not well or not showing up as their best versions of themselves. Sometimes it's hard to separate what impacts what, when and how. But my belief is that there's a lot in the story of Warramunga people here and a lot to be regarded before any kind of judgment might surface about who's doing what and not and what's what and what's where. You know, there are very strong family networks that ensure that children are safe. And there are some family networks that I observe that there are some gaps in that ability to maintain consistent and persistent nurturing. Now, you know, if you didn't know that I was talking about Warramunga people and Warramunga country, maybe I could be describing many, many, many areas of Australia's population. I think parenting and nurturing has become harder and harder for people. There are more distractions. Some things are more, some things, you know, don't change the more they stay the same. There are many reasons why people don't show up in their roles as their best selves, myself included.
I was just thinking about that, actually, this idea of nurturing and the ways that you might be working alongside people to fulfill their roles in the ways that they are hoping to live them. And I wondered whether there was some nurturing in that for you. In what ways does being in that place, being on that country and working with Warramunga people is nurturing for you?
Oh, it gives me so much, Lucy. I think straight away about some of the older women that still smile, still keep going, still make time for a laugh in the midst of, you know, full-on responsibility for many aspects of their family and community and cultural responsibilities. I think about all of the conversations I have and the work that I do closely and intimately with women and families, or also with children. No one over more than 5 years has ever said, "Oh, thanks, Michelle, but I don't need your help. I don't want your help. What you're talking about is, meh, nah, no use to me." Never, not once has that ever been said to me. And so that gives me hope. And it tells me that sometimes some of the things in our lives we have the motivation or the power or ability to change, and some things we don't. And in the midst of that, people are still willing to sit down and talk about how things might change.
I know that we're kind of pushed for time, so I'm going to explore a different area of your work, and that's when you first were studying your Masters of Narrative Practice and Community Work back in 2018. I guess it's not that long ago. Can you tell us a little bit about the project at that time that you were focusing on during your studies? I'm thinking you're going to be publishing this soon. Is that right?
It will be published on a beautiful and quite small level as a part of a collection of stories, a collection of works. Yeah, that's right, through the Dulwich Centre in Adelaide.
Yeah, can you give us a bit of an idea on what you were doing around that time?
Yeah, sure. I love talking about this project. And in some ways it still continues. It's kind of the project itself across 2018 has held the space for some legacy work. I have now, you know, the little brothers and sisters of the children I worked with, mm-hmm. keen to sit down and talk with Michelle. but the work essentially was in response to some pretty heavy events that had happened in town, very, very sad and impactful stories that affected everybody, really, Aboriginal and others. And it was also the time when cultural leaders were rising again over the top of all of the work they already do to say, we need to set some expectations here, we need cultural law to kind of revive and find its place, because people are behaving and acting in ways that no one ever intended and no one ever condones that kind of behaviour in community. And so what I was noticing was a lot of the adult experiences and adult worldview was falling into children's conversations and in children's play and children's drawings. There were things depicted and things talked about that were absolutely not of the realm of childhood. And so I started to think about what we could do to try to assist children to come back or to rest or sit or be held respectfully in the context of childhood. So knowing that there are influences on childhood that come from many angles, how could we help children honour what they came to see as important to them?
Mm-hmm.
And so the project started with a small group of children who were very willing participants, some I'd worked with previously, and also included a couple of children who lived with disability. And we essentially started to talk and walk and play. We did some Tree of Life exercises, exploring values, exploring the good things about life, exploring what was important to them.
Mm.
And through the process of the project, it came that children wanted to invite adults in. Hmm. And so the project changed at their lead to embrace an adult, a family member, a carer, a parent, a nana, to come in to the conversation about holding sacred what children consider important to them in their childhood story, which was a very beautiful project. I also relied on some older women in town to really help guide me and the project, as it was their children, really, that I was working with, in addition to the consent from the actual carer or parent or nana. And so, you know, some of the narrative practices, such as outsider witness. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I would help a child to write a letter to their parent, which talked about the things that were important to them in their life and that they wanted more of in their life. And then we would invite the parent in and I would read the letter to the parent, and then we would talk together about what that letter meant to them. What was it that they thought about when they heard their child's words in that letter? And so it was a kind of facilitating a conversation between the child and the family member that was most private and very, in every case, very impactful.
And these children were in the care of other relatives or foster carers, not living with their parents, is that right? Or
A combination, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So not one specific cohort, but a combination of children. Mm-hmm. So we had a parent, a nana, a foster carer, an older sibling. We had another example is a story that a nine-year-old child wrote to their mother who was living away, and the mother received a letter I phoned the mother to follow up. The mother had some trouble putting her voice to paper, and so I helped her to craft a letter back to her child, and then I posted the letter so that with the mother's words and the mother's consent, living far away, the letter was posted to the child, and the child received the letter, and we read the letter together, which was a very, very moving experience. And to just to hear children talk about their, you know, their warm tummy feelings and remembering their grandfather and welcoming me on a walk. One of the children just found it so difficult to sit still and was much more comfortable moving around. So we walked on country and he welcomed me with open arms to his grandfather's country. And we got to talk about the skills and knowledges that he could identify in himself and how to trace them back and kind of thicken the story of the influences in his life. And he ended up expressing such a strong reconnection to the relationship with his grandfather who had passed.
Can you speak about the significance of sharing these stories by the children with you? What do you think it meant to them to kind of reconnect with these things that they really held precious?
For the children, what they expressed to me was, and that might not have been in, through feedback, but more, you know, in a commitment to keep showing up every week. And when our time together was closing, to want to keep talking about their family and keep talking about what was important to them. There were endless lists of what was important. I think it helped children to have the experience of finding ways to give voice to what mattered to them. And so I think in many circumstances with children, talking about personal agency is not always something that's addressed directly. But in times when adult world pervades children's experiences, I think that's a pretty great time for children to remember or be supported to stake a claim on their right to a childhood in the midst of troubled times, and to prefer to sit in the place of play and fun, even if when the playtime is over, the hard work is still there.
Once you've published your journal article, I wonder if there's going to be opportunities for perhaps other therapists that work with children that are listening to this. Might they have an opportunity to provide some outsider witness accounts to the children's experience? Is that a possibility?
I would love that. I think that's a wonderful idea. I think even though the project was 2018, the children I engaged with most days sometimes get requests, little knocks at my door for me to read. I've always got a copy on hand because the children ask for their letter to be read, or the story that they wrote to be read, or what I wrote about them to be read to them, which is beautiful. So it has currency, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's a living document, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear. Even myself, I can think of a few children that would really appreciate listening to those stories and perhaps want to contribute back in some way. So I will be eagerly waiting for the publication of your article. What do you think's been the biggest learning through engaging in this project? And is there any knowledge you might pass on to perhaps other narrative practitioners that are really interested in working in this way with children?
I think it's obvious. I'm going to start with trust. I think if I'd come as a visitor for the same kind of project, I would have had different outcomes, and I expect perhaps a more surface experience. But there's something about being a visitor to this place on a more kind of permanent basis that really contributed to the work. So the children knew that I knew something of the town struggles, the families, individual family challenges, and their own lives. So not only did I have their trust, but I held a place for their stories. I think, as is the way with narrative practice, you know, the stories are always held close to the person whose story it is. Yet I reflect now on having lived here beyond the collection of those stories and the work we did together. I'm still here. And I think that adds a bit of authenticity to the experience for children. And I know that's not everybody's possibility. So I think what I'm saying there is I'm suggesting an extra mindfulness about working with children on their country and wherever anybody can to invest more deeply produces really rich outcomes for children and their families.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah. Is there any idea on when your publication will come out at this stage? Or
so we're in July. I will definitely keep you posted, but I'm expecting it to be in the next couple of months.
Great. I'd love to put a link on the website once that comes out so that people can access it. Yeah. Or find out a way of accessing it.
Yeah, it most likely will be, definitely will be available on the Dulwich Centre website. It's a collection of stories from Indigenous narrative practitioners from Australia and other places.
Well, I'd love to just check in with you about your broader work there in the community and find out a bit more about the Patterson Street Hub, because I have heard a little bit, and that this is a thriving place for people to come and connect. Can you tell us a little bit about your work there?
Yes, Patterson Street Hub came about because a few of us were listening to community members who talked a lot about the places in town that they needed to be at or they were expected to be at. So there were community development program expectations, there were territory families, you know, rightful expectations about meetings at certain times and family connecting time at certain times, which is all very important, but not a place where people could just drop in, drop by, call in. Mm. And so we sat with that for a while and a space became available, a very quirky space that had been in the town for a very long time, since the 50s, I think it was built, and it became vacant. And so we decided to have a crack at working with others to shape a place where people felt they could sit or bring ideas or share stories or, you know, solo time or time connecting with others. And it was very quickly taken up. Mm. And so now, a couple of years down the track, with the gift of philanthropic funding which pays our rent, mm-hmm. and First Peoples Disability Network have a very important role to play. While they strengthen their presence in Turnip Creek and the Barkly, they also support us as our auspicing agency. So we try for grants all the time to keep projects going. And we like our independence, so we'll see what the funding story brings in the future. But we've been extremely fortunate to have a philanthropic supporter. So we've got another year or so to try and increase that support. We've found some funding to employ a full-time Patterson Street Hub coordinator, which is absolutely wonderful. It gives me time to be progressing other things in town with an eye on the hub. But we just have had so many wonderful things happen there. At the moment, we've got a fellow in town who's giving free guitar lessons to children. So we've got eight or so children that come on Thursday afternoons for free guitar lessons. We've got people that come. We're just about to reinstate our drumming circle. We have a disability peer group that meets. We've had a grandmother's circle that's met regularly. We've had restorative justice conferencing in the space. We've had community talks. And on the other side of the breezeway at Patterson Street Hub is what we call the Hive, which is an open co-working space. So anybody can pay to use that space. And our figuring is that people can bring their expertise to town and be physically placed where we know lots of community members, Aboriginal and otherwise, come to spend time. Mm. And so it's a way of, instead of the old ways generally of organising a meeting, people have to rock up to this place at this time with everything else that's going on in their life. We've got the expertise coming to the people. Mm. And that's helped lots of people in town to engage with legal assistance, with help about security around their homes, with counselling in a safe talking space. We've had women's disability group come to talk about safety and options for people's safety. We've had Ananingi, the local Aboriginal Health Service, do some wonderful outreach around nutrition, healthy lifestyles. You know, the list goes on.
The image of in my mind about this really thriving centre of town, it sounds absolutely wonderful. I'd love to drop in next time I'm going through.
Oh, please do. And anybody listening, please come. We're always trying to find ways for people to come and meet Warramunga country and Warramunga people and
have a cup of tea, hey?
Connect, cup of tea, sometimes a feed, but always a lovely space.
I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't explore quickly just what have been some of the challenges, the struggles, and yeah, what stands out to you as being one of the hardest things about being where you are, doing the work that you're doing?
The compromises that I've accepted. So I accept the compromise of living away from my beautiful old parents and my sons and other family and extended family. It's hard.
Mm.
And it's kind of got a little bit harder, edgy, harder during COVID times, which has planted me more firmly here. I think in other ways, I don't want to kind of sound too altruistic, but some of the hardest things here provide some of the richest opportunities for reflection and working with others on what to do. And I've learnt quite a hard lesson. It pops up all the time. It's not a lesson learned. It's a lesson ongoing about it's easy to be overwhelmed by the vastness of a challenge, but there's always, like the hummingbird story, you know, there's always drops of water to a fire, help in some way. Might not always be able to quantify it, but I know that what I do and I test every day is what I'm doing today or has what I've done today kept me aligned to my purpose and the service of others. It's the small things in each day that I can identify that matter in the midst of overwhelm. And it's a hard lesson, yet it also keeps me from the impact of overwhelm, from being absolutely overwhelmed by the lack of progress, the lack of change, the lack of willingness from some areas to commit to change, but to the small things in people's everyday lives where I can express empathy and experience humility and take action with them is where it's both hard and also it's the salve as well.
I was just thinking of the news that you shared before we started recording about the shop burning down in the community and how that could present as a huge challenge. But your response to that was, oh, well, you know, we just get together and figure out what to do. you know, it's despite the worst things that can happen, there is always some small things we can do. And
yes,
I hear you saying that, you know, we could easily be overwhelmed, but what is it that I can do that will keep me aligned with my purpose? What are the small drops of water I can add to this fire? I love that image. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Just before we wrap up, what's a really quick sparkling moment you can leave us on?
Oh, which one do I choose? I think it sits with the frequent acts of resistance that I notice in the lives of children here. And an example of that is a child coming to me and saying that he wasn't really very happy that the activity that he thought he was going to do was cancelled. And instead of getting cranky, he wanted me to write a letter to that mob to say, why did you cancel that? Because that was the thing I was most looking forward to in my last week before school goes back. And this is a child who might have retaliated at such news in different ways that would not have been very safe for him. But he found me and he said that, I need you to help me write a letter. I'm not happy.
Because you're so good at letter writing, right?
Clearly got that reputation. I love words and I love people. And so that was a beautiful keeping himself safe and needing to give voice to, you know, that's not right. Don't you know that I needed that to happen? I needed that in my day. Don't think that I don't matter, because I do. It's beautiful.
Isn't it? And brings to mind system change. You know, that's what it's all about.
Growing little crops of advocates all over country.
How lovely. Thank you for sharing that story. And just finally, if people would like to connect with you either online or in person and follow up anything about what you've spoken about in your work, how might they best sort of connect with you?
So people can find the Patterson Street Hub online. We have a website. I have a LinkedIn presence. Okay. Mm-hmm. The Hub also has Instagram, beautiful Instagram stories, and that's Patterson Street Hub.
Great.
I am on Insta, and really happy for people. You know, I love people. I love stories. I love hearing from others. So I welcome connection.
Well, I'll put some links to those accounts and the website that you've spoken about so that it will be really easy for people to follow up from our show notes today.
Yeah.
And
Lucy, people should stay tuned too if they're interested, because I'm just developing a small presence in the narrative practice space. It's called Time and Place. Mm-hmm. So that will emerge soon.
Sounds intriguing. I'd love to hear more. We'll have to save that for next time. Thank you so much, Michelle, for joining me today. I know we've been trying to get together and do this for a couple of months, and it's actually really lovely to finally connect with you and to hear the stories you can tell and to hear about the stories you're collecting, and for us to be a little bit of an outsider witness to that process today. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Lucy. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story, music by Flashback Digital. You can access all the show notes from today's podcast at www.metaphoricallyspeaking.com.au. I'm currently on the lookout for inspiring interviewees. If you or someone you know is walking the talk in their work or community, then I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me an email at lucy@metaphoricallyspeaking.com.au or visit my contact page on the Metaphorically Speaking website. Until next time, just keep on walking.